So we're thinking about teaching with authenticity. My background is really in the field of preaching. My training, final degree was at Gordon Conwell in preaching. So I tend to talk about preaching rather than teaching. But if your context is teaching rather than preaching, just translate. It's one letter different or two letters. You can work it out. But I'll slip into talking about preaching. Okay, so just say that at the beginning. I think this is actually quite a huge subject and quite an important one, because we live in a world that, on the one hand, craves authenticity, but at the same time struggles to find it. Okay, so it's interesting when you think about communication in general in society. I know different cultures have different kind of stories and different kind of history. I grew up partly in Italy and partly in England, and certainly the advertising on Italian television was very different than the advertising on English television, and I kind of enjoyed both, but they were different from each other. But as I think about English television, for example, over time, advertising has shifted. All right, there's sort of a different tone to it. As I think about the newsreader, there's a different tone. As I think about comedians, there's a massive shift with comedians. In fact, that might be one of the best examples. I don't know if this is true in your culture, but when I was a child, which is a long time ago now, when I was young, which would have been the 1980s, we were sort of at the tail end of comedians who kind of lived off something weird, either the way they walked or the way they spoke or a certain thing they did. And it was kind of sad, in a sense. They would be interviewed, come onto TV for a TV interview with someone, and then they would just do their thing, and everyone would laugh, and then they'd move off. And you think, if I met that person, they'd probably be drinking themselves to sleep, because it seems like there's nothing there. You know, there's a real kind of sort of quirky, weird performance. And you fast forward a generation, now it seems like comedians that are successful, at least in my culture, tend to be people that you think you can relate to, but they're funny. Do you see the difference? Like, we used to have this one guy who had like this bird puppet, and he used to attack whoever he was talking to. It was funny for about 10 seconds, but he had a career for 20 years doing that. Now, I don't think anyone would be interested. But now, a comedian, there's always something funny, you know, off about comedians, but they seem to be much more normal or relatable. You sort of get the impression that if you met them, that's how they are. And that's a massive difference. That's a shift. If you think about the radio, it used to be that the radio, there was a presenter and they would give information. Now it tends to be two and they talk to each other. You know, it's much more back and forth. And is it scripted? Is it planned? Less obvious if it is. And so it feels like in society there's this sort of shift towards authentic communication, but then you get the kind of agenda-pushing communication. You know, we're going to have a totally normal group of seven people in a house for 3 months and we're going to watch them. You know it's not going to be a normal group of seven people. There's going to be two transgender, you know, everyone else is not going to be heterosexual, and there's going to be all sorts of issues and baggage. And it's trying to present authentic society when you know everywhere you look, that's not the ratio. Do you see what I mean? It's sort of like there's a push coming through to normalize. And so we've got, on the one hand, a move towards authenticity. People want to be able to relate to what they're listening to. At the same time, everybody who's thinking can see through it, and many people aren't thinking and believe it. And it's not authentic in the slightest. And so here we stand in the midst of that as a preacher or a teacher or a Christian in a leadership position. What are we supposed to do? We know we should be authentic. We know there should be authenticity in what we do. But we're in a swirling confusion of society. And it seems like everyone's performing. And it feels awkward and it feels strange. So we want to think about how can we pursue authenticity? What are five things to consider? I suppose the kind of a foundational point that we should keep in mind is the fake or the unreal is not a new phenomenon. It goes right the way back to Genesis 3. Right? As soon as Adam and Eve sinned, what did they do? They took fig leaves and they covered. Right? They were ashamed. The serpent had said to them, you can be like God. And they thought, ooh, hello. And they kind of went for God-likeness. And what did they discover? Nakedness. Right? It's this sort of terrible transaction. You're offered God-likeness. You end up with a profound sense of nakedness. And then your impulse is to cover. And humans have been fig leafing or putting fig leaves over themselves for the whole of human history. It's completely normal behavior. And it's not just them out there. It's our natural tendency. Right now, I'm not saying you shouldn't wear clothes. Big fan of that. Please continue to do that for the rest of the forum. But what about the sort of pretend stuff that we wear? You know, the I'm fine when we're not. The, yeah, things are going pretty good. When inside it's like, oh my word, I'm going to die. You know, that's fig leafing. Or I know the answer to that question. Don't call on me. I don't actually know, but I want to look like I know. That's happening all around us, isn't it? It's sort of showing off, the impressing others. So it's natural fallen human behavior. And here's the real challenge for us. You cannot see it in the mirror. Right? You will not recognize inauthenticity when you think about yourself. Everybody assumes or thinks they are as authentic as can be. And so I find this couple of verses here really helpful. At the end of Psalm 139 in English, if you've got a German Bible, I never know what psalm you're in. But somewhere around 139, it's the famous one, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and rise up. It's a familiar psalm, I think. But right at the end, David says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. See if there be any grievous or wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. I think that's foundationally important for us. Don't take this seminar or workshop and make a list of five things and then work hard and then evaluate yourself and say, I'm doing great. Have that conversation with God. Prayerfully say, Lord, is there anything fake in me? Would you flag that? Would you make me aware? Would you convict me of what is inauthentic? And it may be you're thinking about teaching and God might show you it's something about your friendship or something about the way you act at work or the way you act with your family or something. He's very capable of convicting us, but I think that's where we should be looking. Don't look in a mirror and say, right, how authentic am I? I'm doing great. Because we are very, very good at deceiving ourselves. But when we come to him and pray to him and say, Lord, my desire is to be authentic. That's what I long for. I want to just come across as real so that what I'm saying seems to be genuine, because I want it to be true, that it's real, it's coming from a heart that loves you. And Lord, I know that my heart's messy. I've got the flesh and I've got mixed motives. I know that but I don't know how much, so would you show me? Just be honest with him. And then if you have the courage, talk to someone else as well. Not your best friend who's a people pleaser. Is there any way that I'm inauthentic? No. That's not that helpful. But someone that you trust enough to be honest, is there any way that I come across as inauthentic when I'm teaching, when I'm leading the youth group, when I'm speaking in front of people? Is there anything about what I do that you kind of think, oh, I wonder if... And you make the question low. If you say, do you think I'm a complete fake? No one's going to say, actually, I've been thinking that for years, but now you ask... But if you say, is there any way in which I come across that way? Maybe they would be honest with you and love you enough to say, well, actually, you do get a little bit hyper when you've got a crowd in front of you. And it does feel a little bit, you know, they might tell you. So talk to God about it. Talk to others about it. Don't just talk to yourself about it because you're your best fan and biggest, you know, supporter. But let's get to the five keys. I want us to think about these aspects, if you like, of a preaching, teaching, Christian ministry. So in terms of the goal of authenticity in the preaching, teaching ministry, I want to start by thinking about our preparation. I want to say, okay, authentic preparation takes time. So let me talk in terms of preaching, but like I said, you can translate this into whatever ministry you have. Sunday is the day, normally, right? Sunday morning, typically, got to preach, got to teach, here it comes. If I'm going to be authentic then, I cannot start Saturday. It simply is not enough time. Saturday, I'm in a panic, trying to find something to say, and it's barely going to touch me. I had the privilege of studying with Haddon Robinson, and I remember one of the things he said. He was a teacher of preachers for decades in America. He was Gordon Conwell at the end, and he said one time, I think we've got a problem with the week. The week, you know, 7 days long, Sunday comes really too quickly. And we said, what? What are you talking about? He said, well, you preach on Sunday, Monday you recover, you know, go through all your self-recrimination and depression and all that stuff that you have for a day after you do ministry. And then Tuesday you start again for the next Sunday. That's 5 days. He said, 5 days is not enough. And so we said, well, we can't change the length of the week. That traditionally doesn't work. He said, well, you can do this. You can start the previous Thursday. What? Well, if you start the previous Thursday, give some time to a message that's 10 days out. You've doubled the preparation time. And then you don't look at it again. Friday, Saturday, you're preparing for Sunday. Sunday comes. Monday, you're depressed. Tuesday, you're back to what you started on Thursday. And then Wednesday, you carry out Thursday. That's the following one. Skip that. But Friday, Saturday. So you've taken the same amount of time, but you've extended it. And he said, if you do that, it allows time for the study that you're doing to land in your life. But if you're on the clock and you're rushing, your goal is just to have a message. All right? And if you've ever preached, I'm sure you've experienced that feeling of, I need to have something to say. You start earlier, and actually, he would say, I would say, you can start officially on the Thursday 10 days before, but why not think about the series before the series and do a little bit, maybe even half an hour, for each of the messages weeks ahead? You could even get extreme and plan the whole year and give some time. I know preachers that do that, where they say, I'm going to take a week and think about the entire year's ministry and get some initial work done, because then it's going on in my mind and in my heart, and I keep pondering the passages that are coming. That's a bit extreme, perhaps. But if you're in the habit of saying, Wednesday night's youth group, Tuesday night I've got to prepare, you're going to struggle to be authentic in the sense that your preparation is panicking, trying to get something to say. If you can pull some of those minutes forward, then it's got time to just sit in the back of your heart and back of your mind and ponder it, think about it, chew on it. You know, Selah, in Psalms terms. Let it soak in your life. So I suppose the point that I'm making is that your goal in preaching or teaching or ministry is not just have a message. It's more than that. It's study God's word, let God's word change you, and then figure out a message to communicate to others. But if you squeeze that time, it doesn't change you. You just get to have something to say. And it's a horrible feeling. When you're preaching something that you know technically you believe, but it hasn't had time to land, that's not nice. Now, obviously, I'm in a situation where sometimes the preacher doesn't show up and, hey, Peter, we've got a panic. Can you preach? I've only got 20 minutes. Like, God understands that. But if I did that every single week, then I think my preaching would lack authenticity. Whereas if I can say, I've been studying this passage and it's marked me, I don't always have to say it, but you can kind of tell. It's stirred my heart. It's motivated me. It's challenged me. I've felt it in this way. It improves the preaching and the communication because it's making a difference in me. In fact, mentioned Haddon Robinson, his definition of preaching required it. He said that biblical preaching is the communication of a biblical concept that is derived from and transmitted through a literary, grammatical, historical study of a passage in its context. This is a long sentence. But then he says, which the Holy Spirit first applies to the preacher and then through the preacher to the listeners. He thought it was that important. He put it in his definition that it's not really biblical preaching unless it's marked you first. Now just think how different that is than my job as an educator. What's the information? Got it. Let me communicate it. Like you could just hand out a photocopy of your notes for that. But if it's going to come from your life, if you're going to be incarnational, if they're going to be saying, oh, she thinks that, or he believes that, then it's got to be true for you. So preparation with authenticity takes time. One thing I would add is in your preparation, as well as extending the time, think about how the prayer aspect relates to it. Because it's easy to just kind of create a system, almost like a machine, where you put in your Bible passage and you put in some illustrations and you put in some other things and you stir it up and turn the handle and there's a sermon. Where does prayer fit? Actually, we need to be praying during. We need to stop and deliberately pray and think about the people we're communicating to. And I find it very hard to pray for the people that I'm going to speak to and skip the fact that I need this. Do you know what I mean? I can be an expert Bible student, but I can't be an expert before God. I know that. And so sometimes it's in the prayer stage where I go, whoa, Lord, I need to think this through some more. I need you to make this real for me before I even think about communicating to them. So allow time. Allow time for it to land. Allow time to pray. Allow time, because without time, you're rushing and you're not going to be authentic. Let's go to the second one, which is kind of related. In fact, this is why I'm scratching my head when I look at the notes, because I got down to number four and I had authentic exegesis. Well, that's kind of what I've just been talking about. Bear with me. Okay, so authentic Bible study. That's what exegesis is talking about. It requires diligence. One of the things that can happen when we rush the process is that we go for the familiar. And so it's not just a case of, am I putting the time in to study and prepare and allow it to mark me? There's also the danger of, I haven't got time to study at all, so I'll do what I know, and then I go for a familiar one, and I jump forward in the process. You know what I mean? I'm just rushing to have something to say. I was going to speak on Esther, but I haven't had time to study it, so I'm going to give them the Ten Commandments again. That's what a lot of Sunday school kids have to deal with. Ten Commandments and Sermon on the Mount and obey your parents and never a hint of a gospel. It's a miracle that children ever get saved in some churches, I tell you. So the danger of familiar passages and springboard preaching. What do I mean by springboard preaching? Let me give you an example. Random. Okay? That one. Right. Say stop. Sorry, I didn't hear it.
Stop.
Okay. All right, what have I got? Oof, good night. All right, so Ezra 5:12. Because our fathers had angered the God of heaven, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this house and carried away the people to Babylonia. All right. Springboard preaching is where I just go, I don't know. The God of heaven. Heaven is a great place. Streets of gold, my granddad, Jesus, heaven is awesome. And just preach a sermon about heaven. But, excuse me, what was your text? Oh, it was Ezra 5:12. It wasn't. You just found a word and jumped off it. All right, that's not preaching. That's just random. I mean, you know, I struggled there because I was tempted to start talking about Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, but that's because I've studied the Bible and I kind of want to explain it. All right, let's do another one. That'll do. There. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Body odor in the church. It's a serious issue. I remember hearing a sermon about body odor, but it was quite it was quite relevant. It was on a missions thing. We were being prepared for missions. But do you see what I mean? Like, you can find a word and you can bounce off it and you can leave the Bible behind. That's not biblical ministry. Okay? And so springboard preaching, or slightly better, just going to familiar ones where you know what they say. At least then you're saying the content. But the point is, you're rushing. You're skipping past something. And actually, when I think about the privilege of ministry, one of the biggest privileges that I've felt over the past 20 plus years is those times where I'm stuck in my preparation. Right? Times where I'm looking at a passage and going, I don't know what to do with that. I don't know what it means. I don't understand it. God, the clock's ticking. I'm getting stressed. But I know it's your word, and I know it's good, and I know that it's possible to understand this. Help me. And I keep going. And some of those times, some of the passages where I've thought, ooh, why did I agree to this one? They've been some of the best for me, because I've had the joy of discovery. I remember one time, it's not exactly the same thing, but when I was in Bible school, I had an assignment related to this morning, Revelation 2 and 3. And I got up to the night before, oops, and I got a pile of commentaries from the library, and I had them in my room, and I was getting pretty stressed because deadline was coming and I had to produce this assignment. But I look back on that night as one of the best nights of my life. The commentaries weren't super helpful, to be honest, but then as I kept looking at the text, I gradually started to realize the consistency between the description of Jesus, the promise to the overcomer, and the problem in between. There's kind of a past, present, future thing going on in all seven. And it just came alive. And I remember getting to like 4 a.m. before I was asleep, but I was energized. And it was a privilege to have had that time in that passage. That can happen. But if we just jump to Psalm 23 and Luke 15 and Psalm 23 and Luke 15, we never get to wrestle with things that are difficult. Okay, so authentic exegesis means that you are growing. If you're only doing what's familiar, it means you probably aren't. And wherever you are, even if it's a familiar passage, I think it's a good principle to study deeper than you need to teach. Right? So maybe you're teaching three-year-olds. They're not going to ask any tough questions about Middle Eastern shepherding. Right? They're not going to test your knowledge. Your challenge is to keep them engaged for more than 6 seconds, you know? But you should still study it better than you need to say it. What about with adults? I would say study more. And one reason for that is because you can present something and you can present it carefully and clearly and compellingly, and people can be like, whoa, that was amazing. And then they ask you a question and you're like, I've got no idea. That's all I had. And it's like they tap you and you fall apart. That's awkward. You don't want that. I like to be prepared so that I'm communicating to normal people, but if I then get the Greek scholar trying to show off, I'm ready to have the conversation if necessary. Obviously, you can't do that if you haven't studied Greek, but the principle still applies. Read more, know more, be aware more, so that when someone says, I don't get that, or I'm not sure about that, or don't you think it could be this way? You've got an answer to be able to explain. Okay, so your study, your preparation requires diligence. We've said that authentic preparation takes time. Authentic exegesis takes diligence, which also takes time. So those two really are very similar. Let's go for another one. Number three, authentic connection. And what I mean by that is the connection between the text and the listener. All right, so it's not really your authenticity at this point, it's the authenticity of the message. But there has to be a genuine connection. I can think of some really bad examples of lack of connection. I don't know if you have this in your culture, but in England, there's a lot of churches that love to have a children's talk. All right, so in the middle of the service, they go, right, time for the kids' talk, and all the children come and sit on the front, and then the person who's leading it does a thing that's supposed to be accessible to the children. Now, generally the smart ones are actually communicating to the adults with something fun for the children. And some churches, I heard of one recently, where someone had to do the children's talk, even though there were no children there, which is the ultimate awkward moment. But one of the things that happens in children's talks that are not particularly good is the person says, I've got something interesting. Okay, it could be a can of beans, it could be a bag of chips, it could be a paper aeroplane, it could be a flower. It doesn't matter. It's got something interesting, so that it's kind of show and tell, and the kids go, ooh, right? So you start with that, you say some things about it, and then you make the connection. You say, that's a bit like Jesus. And then everyone in the room goes, no, it's not. Or that's a bit like us. Not really. I remember one time, literally, the power of bad communication. This was about 40 years ago. I was a child when I heard this. A can of baked beans. You know what baked beans are? Like beans in tomato sauce. It's a uniquely British bad idea. The preacher said, got a can of baked beans. Who likes baked beans? You know, who's had baked beans today? So everyone's engaged, right? I can't hear them complaining. That's fellowship. I remember as a child going, pretty sure that's not fellowship. It just feels like it's a bit of a reach. But you see, as a preacher or as a teacher, there's nothing wrong with illustrations, by the way. Please do be creative. Just make sense. You're kind of building a bridge between two worlds. Right? John Stott wrote a book called Between Two Worlds, funnily enough, about preaching. And he said that the preacher is a bridge builder. And we've got to start in the world of the Bible text. We've got to know that world and be familiar with it and understand it and know what it means. And then we've got to build a bridge over to our listener's world. And he said churches tend to make one of two mistakes. He said the conservatives tend to be in the Bible and then go straight to heaven and never touch down in real life. He said liberal churches, they tend to be all about real life but have nothing to say. He said, no, biblical preaching is world of the Bible to the world of the listener. Now just think about that for a second. What do we have on both sides of that divide? In the Bible, we have an incredibly, an amazingly real depiction of reality. Yeah? I made a comment this morning in our network where I said, we have a tendency to sort of, how did I put it? We make every Bible character out to be almost perfect. The only ones we ever really criticize are Jezebel, Ahab, and Judas Iscariot. Everyone else, we believe the best. But actually, praise God, the Bible is full of people that are very real, not people who are superheroes, you know? And if you go through it, you start to realize, oh my goodness, yeah, David, oh yeah, he did that. Moses, oh yeah, and Abraham, well, twice. You go through and you kind of think about all the flaws and the weaknesses and the... I just read through Judges with my two younger girls at breakfast, that last two chapters. I was like, oh, how do I communicate? Like, how do I read this? And my girls are like... and he cut her into pieces. Okay, let's keep moving. But it's real. It's kind of like gritty. It's not this fake, plastic, nice, you know, everybody's nice in the Bible. No, Jesus, perfect. But everyone else got issues, all of them. Okay, so the Bible is full of sin, of human nature, of evil. Like all the realities that our world needs to hear about, the Bible's got it. Corruption, everything, human trafficking, like you can find connections to all the evils when you read the Bible. The Bible's real. So the reality of that can land in the reality of this. Okay, but what we sometimes do is we go, nice, nice, and we build this connection between kind of not real understanding of the Bible with not real understanding of life. Actually, why not dig down? Why not let the authenticity of the message come across? You know, I think if we're preaching to people in real life situations, we don't help them by just giving them superficial statements from the Bible. We help them much more by letting them see the reality of human sin and corruption and brokenness and rebellion and all the evil that's there in the text by God's gift to us, so that we can hear what he has to say in the evil, corruption and madness of our world. And so I wonder if that's something worth thinking about. Do I tend to kind of avoid the gritty realities of the Bible and avoid the gritty realities of my listeners and then just say nice things? Sometimes you realize, ooh, I'm preaching to a congregation, I've got a message, I thought it was okay, and then I've just looked and realized who's just walked in, their dad died on Thursday. I just realized who walked in, they just had a miscarriage. I realize who walked in, their country's being attacked or whatever. They're in the real world. And if I'm just making kind of adult versions of children's stories, do you know what I mean? I almost wonder if that's even worse than they looking at me thinking you're fake. Because I don't want them looking at this thinking it has nothing to say. And so obviously pray that through and think that through. But let's have the conviction the Bible is relevant. It is useful. It does speak into the realities of our world and into the realities of our experience, which, going back to what we've said before, has to land in us before we can communicate it effectively to others. All right, let's go back to point two in my notes, which makes no difference if you're not looking at them. But point two, this is kind of building on what I just said. But if the Bible is rich in reality and it speaks into the chaos and nonsense and madness of the reality of our world, that brings the question and the spotlight back onto the preacher. And the question is, do I have the courage to say it? And this is a big one. And I'm wrestling. If someone said to me, what's the biggest thing you're thinking about this year? It's this point right now. How do we think through having courage to speak in a world that's going crazy? Okay, because there's all sorts of issues, and you could say there's always been issues. Okay, fine. But I think in some ways the issues are of a different nature. Think back 50, 60, 70 years, 1960s. Apparently, it was before my time, but the 1960s, the sexual revolution, there's a whole load of people saying, oh, free love, do what you want, doesn't matter. What were they doing? Rebelling against the rule and the standards that had been passed down to them. So there's kind of an overt rebellion at the level of behavior. But fundamentally, they sort of took the morality of a Judeo-Christian world and said, yeah, but I don't care. Today, we don't have that. Today, we don't have acceptance of the morality of a Judeo-Christian world. We have an entire transformation of morality. Do you see the difference? So it's not just they used to rebel that way, now people rebel this way. No, now there's a shift in terms of what is right, what is wrong. Before, people either obeyed or disobeyed, but they agreed. Now, there's a whole new set of rules. All right, and by the way, if you haven't noticed, that means that we are wrong. You go, well, hang on, I haven't done anything. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the 2020s. In fact, everything post 2010, there's been a shift. And the shift is, you're wrong. How can you say that? Well, you're Christian? Yeah, you're wrong. Are you white? Yeah, you're wrong. Are you Western? Yeah, you're wrong. Are you heterosexual? Yeah, you're wrong. Male? Extra wrong. Like everything about who we are, our identity now defines our rightness. Which means that you can then be talking to someone else, and their identity defines their rightness, so you have nothing to say to them because they're not all those things that you are. Okay, that's different. My grandfather never faced that, never had to get his brain wrapped around intersectionality. It wasn't a thing yet. But now, ethics are changed. And then and then there's so much more. So we're being rocked by cultural, moral, touchy issues. All right? It's issues that just trigger response. Race. You know, it kind of strikes me. I understand that race is an important issue, but it does strike me as being sometimes a little bit out of proportion. In this sense, okay, so I'm thinking, just let me be shallow, I'm thinking football, okay? That's part of my world. And I'm especially thinking football this week because the greatest team in the world beat the greatest team in the world and won the cup on Saturday, so I'm still buzzing from that, but I won't get into that. But in football, when I was a child in England, racism was all over the place, right? The chanting, it was offensive, it was wrong. I remember having magazines with players in, and my parents being like, we're visiting the relative that's going to be a bit awkward because of that person's color. That, I lived in the 80s, and that was normal. Today, my son doesn't even think about skin color, doesn't cross his mind. Who are his favorite players? Him, and him. What color are they? It doesn't matter. It doesn't cross his mind. He's never had to think of that. And then I turn on the television, and what do I hear? Oh, racism. Oh, this is great. It's as great a problem as it's ever been in English football. I'm like, are you kidding? It's still a problem. I get it. It's wrong. But it's like it's being driven and pushed and stirred up. And you know, race, MLK, very different era than CRT and what that's trying to achieve. Right? The whole kind of critical race theory, the deconstructive power of that, call everything racist until you control it, is kind of the way society's functioning now. You cannot quote MLK and be seen positively in that world. All right, when the whole BLM thing was happening a few years ago, I made a point several times in sermons of quoting MLK because I knew that for people that weren't really aware, they'd go, oh, good, he cares about, you know, Black Lives Matter. But for people who were aware, they'd go, oh, he's not affirming Black Lives Matter because he's quoting content of character rather than color of skin, which is the exact opposite of what CRT is doing. So do you see the complexity? The same label, a different agenda. And it's scary. And so there's race, there's sexuality, there's gender, there's all the medical stuff related to COVID. I mean, there's all these things that are... I can't say that. Oh, don't go there. Oh, my word. Oh, careful. And there's this narrative that's being pushed, and there's an acceptable position on things. And so we've got a world that's being rocked by all sorts of stuff. And what are Christian leaders doing? This is the thing that I'm wrestling with. It feels like they're hiding behind the gospel. Now, don't mishear me. The gospel is the hope that we have to offer. Absolutely. Our ministry should be about the gospel, and it should not be about political soapbox, you know, agendas. It certainly shouldn't be about pushing party politics. I'm not saying that. But Christian leaders have a responsibility to proclaim the gospel and to stand for truth. And during the last 4 years, I've been really troubled by that. I've been looking at things going, something's not right here. That doesn't seem to add up. That seems to be wrong. Information's coming, oh my word, that seems to be corrupt. Oh, that's costing lives. Oh, that's doing damage. Oh my goodness. And I'm kind of watching it, and then I'm going on to Twitter for my normal group of kind of Christian influencers and go, John 3:16, isn't God good, isn't God good? I'm like, okay, yeah, I totally agree, but you're going to say something. The world's gone mad, people are dying, things are happening, and no one's saying anything. And that's just bugging me. We got to a point a year and a half ago, something like that, where we put in our newsletter just a line. We just said, Melanie and I are really troubled by some of the things that are going on relating to this whole pandemic. And we're not going to put anything in here, but if you want to know, get in touch. So we had all these people say, well, what are you thinking? And so we sent them like a PDF. This is our concern. And we had about 50 people write back to us and say, finally, a Christian leader saying something. I was like, whoa, I barely said a thing. But there's all these people who are sat in churches watching leaders scared to speak. right? Scared to question. Can't go against that. Can't ask a question. What about the science? What about this? What about that? I remember going, I know this is a touchy issue and I'm probably going to offend half of you now, but I remember going to my dentist, right? Which I can't do anymore because his waiting list is too long, which is frustrating. But anyway, I went to my dentist and it was at the stage where they were talking about masks. And he said, oh, masks, that's ridiculous. They don't do anything. The only reason I wear a mask is so I don't spit in your face. And I'm like, okay. It's a bit weird. But he said, honestly, the breath's going around it. It doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. You know, there's no science to support it. He's given me this whole speech. A few months later, I go back. Everything's masked, including him. And I can't walk into the building without one. And I'm like, hey, George, what's going on? Totally changed. I'm like, what? Have you seen some science to change your view? Because you were informed before, and what's going on? I'm not making a judgment on that. Oh, I am, but, you know, I don't care what you think about masks. It's not currently an issue. But it kind of bothered me that what the media said was what everyone had to believe, and no questions allowed. And so what happens then if something like that is being driven, whatever that is, right? There's an agenda, there's a narrative, you must do this, you mustn't do that. Let me make one up so that we get away from the kind of touchiness of COVID. What about, let's imagine that the media decided that if we don't carry in our hands a packet of crisps at all times, then everybody's pet cat is going to die. Let's just make one up, right? And so suddenly everyone's like, I love cats. I don't want anyone's cat. I don't love cats, but she loves cats. I don't want her cat to die. So everyone's doing the crisp cat thing, right? What about if you're watching that going, I'm not convinced that's true. But I can't say it because then I'll be attacked as a cat hater. And what happens then if 2 years later, people start going, hang on a minute, they made that up. Hang on a minute, that wasn't true. Hang on a minute, the science wasn't there. Oh my word, what happened? Oh, they were paying for that? And all this stuff comes out about the cat agenda. And then everyone looks at you and you go, well, yeah, I knew that, but I was scared to say it. That's where I'm wrestling with it. I'm just finished reading a book written by a German politician in 1939. All right, so really interesting timing. He'd watched 6 years of the Third Reich. But he didn't know the next 6 years. And he's kind of writing a history of how did the German Republic become the Third Reich from his perspective. Fascinating book to read. And the other thing that kind of stood out as I was reading it with an agenda. I wanted to see the church. What did the church do? And when he got to the chapter to talk about the church, he said, well, the Catholic Church had an agreement with the Nazi Party because they wanted to still have their position in society. The only restriction was they couldn't say anything political. So they kept their voice, but couldn't say anything. And then it moved to the Protestants, and the Protestants, especially the wealthy and the educated ones, also were scared to say anything. And it's like, oh man. There was the potential to stop the evil before it became the Holocaust. Could have been stopped politically by my country and others, could have been stopped societally, but it said multiple times, even though there was still a chance to stop it, the will was already gone. People thought it was too late, so they didn't say anything. And I'm reading that thinking, whoa, that cost millions of lives. Now, if you don't think the world's shifting massively, start watching something other than the main news. Obviously, Ukraine, the Middle East, there's wars, right? There's all sorts of agendas. There's all sorts of ideologies, all sorts of things going on. My fear is that we'll watch it, we'll watch it, we'll watch it, and then when it's too late, we'll say, yeah, I knew that was a problem, and we'll have no credibility. So I'm not saying be political. I'm not saying push this or that or the other. I don't really want to get into different views, But the question is, do we value acceptability over credibility? I felt it during the COVID thing because I had people in my church that were right across the spectrum from desperately, desperately scared and committed to certain things to people that were desperately, desperately skeptical and against certain things. And I felt the pressure to not offend people. We're going to feel that. with youth ministry, gender, sexuality. What do you do when you've got someone who's transitioning within your youth group? Does that make you scared to speak about it? Of course it does. But if you don't say anything, imagine that. You know, they say once somebody's transitioned surgically, their suicide rate is like 40%. Imagine them discovering that you knew that that would happen and you never told them. Do you see, we can go into any area of all the different ideologies that are swirling around. And I'm not telling us what to believe. I'm not telling us what to say. I'm not saying how we should say it or anything like that. I'm just saying, do we have the courage to be authentic? Do we have the courage to be credible when things start to come out? Or will we just say, well, I was trying to be acceptable. I didn't want to ruffle any feathers. I didn't want anybody to be upset. Oof. The authentic courage of Christian ministry requires faith and wisdom and gentleness and firmness and care. It requires a whole lot of stuff, but let's not shy away from it. Okay, we do not want to settle for acceptability over credibility. Let's go on to the last one. I think I've done four, haven't I? Yep, so number five, authentic communication. This is the actual kind of communication part. Authentic communication is very, very powerful. So how do you make your actual speaking authentic? That feels hard, doesn't it? Well, basic thoughts here, but don't act. Honestly, it's not cool. You know, like Billy Graham, amazing preacher. Don't try to be like Billy Graham. You know, John Piper, great. Don't try to be like John Piper. You be you. Okay, and if your personality is big and fun and loud, let that come out. People appreciate you being you. But if your personality is quiet and gentle and thoughtful and precise, be that. That's fine. You know, don't be intimidated by extroverts. All right? Extroverts, praise the Lord. You know, they're great. But we don't all have to be one. And if you're an introvert, if you're quiet, if you're shy, that's okay. God can still use you. But you do need to think about, how can I be natural in the way that I communicate? Because the temptation is to think, right, if I'm not acting like, woo, look at me, then the alternative is just very bad communication where I don't communicate very well at all, you know, and you just do that and you freeze. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that when you're in a conversation in the corridor about a subject you care about with a friend, when you feel safe, and it could be, you know, your pet cat or your football team or your grandchild or, you know, your fiance or whatever, whatever it is that you're passionate about, you communicate really well. You're engaging, you're excited, you're a bit bigger, a bit louder than normal. When you stand in front of people, you naturally freeze. All right, it's true, isn't it? People talk about the fear of public speaking. It's because we freeze. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I'm panicking here. How do we become natural in that? We don't want to pretend to be something we're not. But we do need to work at letting ourselves come through. So if you find that your hands get locked and you're normally Italian with your hands, you know, and suddenly you've got no gestures, practice letting your hands go a little bit so that you can still communicate your way. If you find that your voice gets kind of frozen, thank you, in kind of a monotone, practice going up and down and loud and soft, and practice in other settings. Not so that you can act, but so that you can be you. You need to be able to do the work in order to communicate naturally, okay? And honestly, there's kind of lots that could be said, but let me just say two things, and then we'll take any questions that we've got left. But one part of it is you've got to know your material. You've really got to know what you're talking about. If you're scrambling trying to remember stuff or inside trying to figure out how to finish your message, you're going to struggle to deliver with any naturalness, any authenticity, because your brain is in overdrive trying to find something. So you've really got to know it. I remember when I was at Bible school, start of a preaching class, first day, my teacher said, you're going to preach this semester, I think it was three times, and you're not going to use notes. And if you use notes, you fail. And I was like, that's really funny, because I've preached for like 10 years and I've always used notes, and oh, am I really serious? And he was. And he taught us to preach with no notes, and I am so thankful for that, because I've not gone back. Now, that doesn't mean I've got this incredible memory. It means that I keep my message as simple as I can. I stick to the text. I plan it well, and I run through it ahead of time. I mean, it's not magic, you know, but what does it mean? It means that A, I know my material, and B, I can do the ultimate thing for authenticity, the ultimate thing for credibility. Do you know what that is? Eye contact. That's huge. You go and try to buy a car from someone who won't look at you. You will not be able to force yourself to give them money, because you just know they're not looking at me. You know, oh, that's a nice car. Yeah, mate, that's a lovely car, that one. That's one owner and perfect car, no problems whatsoever. You know, you'll never find a more reliable car than that. It's like, no thanks. But if they look at you, you start to trust them. Now, they can fake that, of course, but for us, we've got something good, and we've prayed for the people, and we love them, and so we want as much eye contact as possible. You can't do that if you're spending your whole time reading your notes and kind of stuck in your notes or looking at your PowerPoint. And so anything you can do to increase eye contact is going to help with that perception of authenticity. But notice that I've taken about 2 minutes on that, and I've taken about an hour on actually be authentic. Just adding eye contact doesn't cut it. But if you can get the content and the study and the preparation and the working in your life and the courage to speak and all that stuff, if you can have the connection between Bible and life and all the reality there, then when it comes to actually speaking, make as much eye contact with people as you can. Don't stare them down. That's intimidating. You know, it makes men want to fight and girls want to run away when someone just locks eyes on them. But just 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds, you know, meaningful eye contact, move on. I make eye contact with people that aren't even looking at me, no problem. You see, because it's so valuable. And honestly, I preached for 10 years with notes. I preached for 20 years without. I wouldn't go back to notes unless I had to. Because the value of that sense of connection, oh, it's priceless.